Hello and welcome to the Tech Dirt Podcast. I'm Mike Masnick.
The world is increasingly technological, so we have better get methodical. Bringing precision to critical digital journalism with the singular vision of the modern monocle. Stopping the copyright bullies from pulling the wool on us. Facing and taking on all the blatant paid to troll. Document the ways that they aim to take control. Scrutinize and do their lies and make them fold. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the tech dirt. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get hurt. To grab a shovel and dig up the tech
A few months back, I'm actually forgetting exactly when it was, but we ran a guest episode on this feed, which was Danny O'Brien, who is the senior fellow at the Filecoin Foundation for the Decentralized Web, interviewing me for his podcast. And today we're flipping the script and I'm going to have Danny as a guest on my podcast. If you listen to that episode, you will know that Danny and I go way, 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 way back. I'm not sure if that was enough ways or maybe we need a few more.
Oh God, we need more ways. That's disturbing. Okay.
And also that Danny is somewhat instrumental in accidentally maybe inspiring me to create Tech Dirt, in that I read his email newsletter called Need to Know and feeling somewhat overwhelmed with how wonderful it was, I immediately copied the entire format, including some of the section headings, and launched my own newsletter that looked suspiciously like Need to Know. And that newsletter eventually morphed into Tech Dirt. And also, it took all of maybe 3 or 4 weeks of me sending out a newsletter for somebody to forward it to Danny.
But, you know, it's our own comeuppance for advocating for a liberal copyright regime.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Like, when something like that happens, you can't go, well, some people do, right? Some people
go,
okay,
yes.
I'm going to sue you for, look and feel. But mostly you just go, yeah, this is exactly how I planned it. This is good. Competition is good. But like, to set the scene, this was in 1997?
97,
It's that many long ago.
Yes.
So, yeah, at least 4 or 5 cycles of tech hype, tech doom.
Gone. Yeah, we were in the upswing of tech hype in 97. And yes, on that note of like the copyright stuff, I do remember very, very clearly what you wrote about the newsletter, which was, as you wince.
What did I say? Oh, God.
No, it was good. It was good. What you said was, the only kind of IP I believe in is internet protocol. So as not to say that you were going to come after me with a copyright claim of any sort.
Phew. Because, and I don't know whether we're recapitulating our other podcast interview, but like my whole experience with doing NTK, which was a sort of scurrilous gossip zine of the UK tech scene primarily, is just endless generations of people coming up to me and saying, oh yeah, I know you. You wrote about me once. And me going, what did I say? Because it had a style, right?
Yes.
And I think one of the things that I don't know what was overdetermined in that period of like the internet growing. Like mostly the issue there is you were just first. So everything.
Right.
I have 4 friends who invented laws, like Betteridge's law is Ian Betteridge, who I used to go to the pub with. And like, it wasn't a profound insult. Sorry, Ian, the questions should usually be answered in the negative.
Right.
But they were on the internet, so everybody just copied it.
Yep.
And I think one of the things with NTK is that we quickly developed this sort of snarky voice because it just seemed appropriate, right? And we were ripping off suck.com with an S, just for those of you listening in audio. And like now, like that is a whole, like snark became a cultural hallmark of of internet journalism, right?
Yeah.
And there's no connect, like just being the first to sort of explore that area doesn't mean that you had some particular insight, but it is sort of interesting when you watch that turn into an industry. And the same with newsletters, right? Email yeah. newsletters. Like there's something there that is quite powerful, and like it goes away because suddenly everybody has an email newsletter, and then no one does, and then it comes back again. I think it's coming back again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the first thing I was going to bring up was just like, it's funny, like both of us really started as, you know, email newsletter people in the 90s. And then, you know, all that went away and there were blogs and then social media and everything. And now we're like in this weird renaissance of the email newsletter.
But like maybe a secondary renaissance, right? I think there's, sorry to like just yeah, imply no. that we're just trapped in this time loop, but like, I feel like there was another one in the middle.
Yes,
like there was true. Maybe pre Substack, there was sort of the tiny letter. There yes. was like a little,
which just shut down by the oh, way. I don't know
really?
If you saw that.
Well, there yeah. you go. That's yes. absolutely the cycle, right?
Yes.
Like you have a kind of artisanal, moment where people go, oh, this is cheap and fun right. and I can do it. And then somebody goes, oh, we can totally turn this into a multi-million dollar industry, right? We'll get VC funding.
Yeah.
And then those things sort of die away and it becomes less fun. But you get something that is, cross fingers, right? Kind of sustainable. So I can exclusively reveal on your podcast, Mike, that we were offered, Slashdot offered to buy us out.
Really?
Yeah, at peak.
Wow.
At peak. So just to fill people who aren't already dead, that Slashdot was like, I guess like, you know, kind of like Reddit. The Paul Graham just wrote a thing talking about the early days of Reddit. Uh-huh. And sort of saying how Reddit stepped into where Slashdot had been.
Right.
And Slashdot got a bunch of money and they offered to buy us, I think, for like $20,000 or something.
Huh.
And both a lot of money, but also in a foreign currency, right? So we I was based in the UK and we were like, how do we even transfer that into a bank account? And we decided against it just because we were like, it's not going to be fun if we're doing it for,
right.
for someone else. And I think that's part of what the transition you'll see with newsletters now is that, you know, how do you sustain something like that so that it is still fun for you?
Right.
And I think that's one of the things, I hope people will forgive us for being quite this incestuous, but it's one of the things that I really like about, or admire about Tech Dirt, right? Is uh-huh. that there's a feeling that you've been doing it for a million years, but it's still, you get to preserve the thing that people like about it and you preserve the thing that you like about it.
Yeah.
Right? And I was looking at, I think it was either Tom's Hardware or Ars Technica the other day. And I was sitting there going, have they kept it? And I will keep it ambiguous which one I was looking at so that it doesn't sound like I'm criticizing it. But one of those, I was like, I don't think you have. And one yeah. of them, I was like, yeah, this still carries the spirit of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting to see how these things change. And often it's, you know, I mean, sometimes it's just certainly the realities of running a business that if you want to do something full time, that it has different realities. And then you get into the whole like enchidification curve process.
Yeah. Although, yeah, I think the other part of it though, is that the thing that I think was very exciting at that point, and I sort of almost have to try and convince people is still potentially the case, is having an almost like zero capital, zero outlay thing that you can do, right?
Yeah.
Like that has very low barriers to entry. And I think the upside of that, right, is low barriers of entry. Anyone could do it, right?
You
can stumble into it. And so the great thing about kind of the mailing list renaissance is we're hearing all of these new voices. I mean, lots of the headlines are about, you know, the Matt Iglesiases of that. Mm-hmm. But that's because they came from a previous generation and, you know, the newspapers or whatever know who they are. Right. But it's that process of bringing in new voices. The downside of it, and I think the thing that sort of chokes it off, is suddenly everybody has a freaking Substack, right?
Right.
And there's too much to read. And then you, again, one of the inspirations for NTK was like, I realized that just keeping track of everybody else's mailing list was a full-time job. So I could simply summarize what everybody else was saying.
Right.
And I say I mean, it was 75% written by Dave Green, who was the funny one. And I should be careful about that. But so there's always this point where, or there always has been a point of like an opportunity to bring a lot of knowledge, a lot of process, you know, a lot of thought to it. And then, shit, we're drowning in this information, and then a reconsolidation. It's why I'm actually not too worried about like the AI slum kind of drowning thing where people are like, oh my God, like, this is the last moment of a genuine internet. It's
right.
Like the analogy they always use is like, you know, post atomic war,
right,
steel or something. Yeah. Where after the atom bomb has gone, like everything's kind of radioactive. And so you have to look for pre-war steel. I'm mangling that. but that is only understandable if you have already heard that anecdote. But I don't think that's a problem, because it's a problem that we've gone through on many different cycles. Email was going to die because of spam.
Yep.
And spam still exists. Spam is probably still 90%, I don't know, of SMTP traffic.
Right.
It's just we don't see it. And I think that's what you always do, is like you try and like work out how to attenuate the signal.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And this is not what we were planning on talking about, but this is fun to talk about anyway.
But we did predict that we would play wildly.
I still have a topic that I'm going to get to, but it is interesting because there are all these discussions now about how like AI generated content is just going to like completely flood the world. But I'm sort of interested in the idea that at the very same time that is coming up, there's also this like rebellion against algorithms and like recommendation algorithms.
Interesting.
And it's like those recommendation algorithms are what's going to save you from the AI sludge.
Yeah. And like I was, you know, the thing years of experience give you, right, is you realize that you know, constants aren't and variables won't, right? That like things that you thought were just truths about the world change.
Yeah.
And things that you assume were really contingent on the current moment, and like if you push, you know, you could change them, or that they were going to collapse or something, just don't. And I think one of those things for me is that the degree of kind of error and brokenness. So there's two examples I have. One of which is just my favorite thing that I quote to people all the time. And I will just send you the link later because I can't remember this, who wrote it or whatever. But Jonathan Stray, who is a really good researcher, pointed it out many years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a fairly resilient test over 100 years or more of the number of actual errors, trackable errors, in an article, a newspaper, a news article, journalist article. And his point was, seems pretty constant. From the days of yellow journalism to, you know, the collapse of reporting to the rise of disinformation, if you take an average article and test it for, let's be clear, right, testable facts, right? I think the strategy they used was calling up the people who were in the article and saying, like, what did you, like, were these things that the reporter said correct or not? Hmm. And it's higher than journalists would prefer, right? But probably lower if you have a pessimistic view of the current day's journalism. So that's just a constant.
Right.
The other one is a paper that just came out, and someone I read on someone's Substack, right, was about the degree of toxicity, in heavy quotes, okay, in thread discussions, in internet discussions. And they have, mm-hmm, they took old Usenet posts, they took Reddit, they took some other like intervening kind of forums. Okay. And same thing, right? Like it's not, there's some variance. I think, right, they noted that it was lower on Facebook than others.
Incredibly. In a, yes,
complete irony, right?
Yes.
But it was still roughly the same, which makes me wonder, you know, I am totally of the generation that we are of going, oh yeah, you know, the advertising model or the search for clickability and so forth, you know, completely ruined, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That's my instinctive reaction. And now I'm sitting there going, oh God, maybe this is just human nature. Right. And you're always going to be, always going to be frustrated by obvious errors in,
right,
reporting or assholes, you know,
toxicity. Yeah, yeah. It's like it makes me think that like Godwin was right to assign a constant to this.
So that's another interesting thing about this paper, is one of the things they also measure is how likely, like what's the correlation between length of thread, uh-huh, and toxicity.
Oh, interesting.
And the longer a thread goes, the more likely it is to, right, in an interesting way, right?
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, it is actually experimental proof of Godwin's, Mike Godwin, one of those people I know,
yes,
who invented a law. So, right. So yeah, I think that there is some evidential.
Wow.
Stuff behind that.
That's really interesting. I will need you to send me those links because that's really fascinating.
That's two tech dirt articles at least.
Yes.
Out of this, right?
To add to my list. I'm sitting here with like, I think it's about 400 tabs open, probably most of which have things in them that I'm like, I'm going to write about this. I will find time one of these days to like go through all of it. But
for those of you who've never seen your host working remotely, like the thing that Mike is famous for in conferences and things like that is he sets up his laptop. Like we're all there in like, you know, little laptop. And Mike sits down and he sets up like a PC station, right, with like, yeah, monitors, additional monitors,
yeah,
and then just to have room for all the tabs that he's constantly processing.
Yeah.
I hope that's not.
That's fine. Yes, I have a second monitor just for my tabs.
Pretty much, right? Like, yes, you're always like, oh my God, you're unwrapping your like your news. It's like one of those satellite bags, right?
Yes.
Like old style TV stations have, where they turn out and they put up a big satellite dish. It's like, oh, Mike's here to report.
Yes, yeah. I've been meaning to. I wrote an article about my mobile setup about like maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and I've since like upgraded piece by piece of it. So I have like
has it got bigger or smaller?
It has gotten smaller and more compact and lighter and quicker and easier to set up, though I am eyeing a piece of equipment that would send it in the other direction, but I'll leave that aside for now.
Just a cliffhanger as to whether like, yeah.
And again, I imagine the conversation is gonna hit on a bunch of different points. But there is something that I did want to talk about, and there was
you remember what it was?
A specific reason why I asked it, which is that one of the projects that I did last year, in association with the Filecoin Foundation, for the decentralized web, which, mm-hmm, of which you are a part, and of which you sort of brought me in to work on this project, was putting together a magazine all about decentralization. And we helped find and curate a bunch of different articles, all of which are wonderful and interesting. But I contributed an article to that, and you contributed an article to that.
I did.
And I keep bringing up your article in conversations with people because it keeps feeling really relevant and really interesting. And some of that may touch on stuff that we have already discussed, but I did want to talk a little bit about that article. Yeah. And in particular, it is, you talk about the concept, two concepts and related concepts in here, of terminal values and then cognitive liberty. And you talk about that in the context of decentralization. So, do you want to give sort of a quick summary of like what that article is and kind of what your thinking was in writing it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never sure how quick I'm going to be, but to give the sort of, you know, the dictionary definitions there, because both of these are terms that I grabbed from other people. So terminal values is sort of this way of trying to separate the values that you have because they achieve certain aims, right? Which are instrumental values, right? Like you may not like super believe in your heart that like setting the tax rate to 45% is like, you know, what you've dreamt of doing, but that is an instrumental value, right? You might like say, yeah, higher taxes are good for society or lower taxes are good for society. And then you have terminal values, which is what you kind of, what is the good thing that you are trying to go for? So in that case, it might be if it's low taxes, you might go greater freedom for people to make choices about what their money goes to. And even that's not quite terminal. You have to keep going, yes, but why is that good? Why is that good? And then you come to a shorter set of kind of overarching goals. Right. And like my background, and I'm glad we haven't mentioned this so far because I've suddenly realized I say it a lot, which is I used to be at EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as director of strategy there for a few years. And the reason I don't like to talk about it is because when you're at EFF and people go, oh yeah, other people go, I used to be at EFF. You're like, yeah, but you're not now. So why don't you go and do your own thing? Stop living off your laurels. But it does give you, you have to deal with these kind of issues like all the time because you're literally kind of like doing practical things in the world, but you're also trying to scope out like, is DRM good? No. You know, you're actually trying to agonize over the details, right? Same with like, I imagine the Free Software Foundation or someone like that.
Right.
Anyway, so we dealt a lot with like we're defending civil liberties, we're defending human rights on the internet. What does that mean? I began to sort of separate, what is this? Particularly because, as one might imagine, the last 10 years have been a lot of like introspection in that community, you know, which is what I describe as the are we the baddies kind of conversation where you're like going, oh, I advocated for free speech for 20 years and now everyone hates free speech except for a bunch of people that I hate or whatever, right? Yes. And, you know, people
with newsletters on Substack, strangely enough.
But. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. I never have time to read it. But yeah. Yeah. Right. Of course. Right. Substack itself.
Yes.
So, you know, I too was doing my set of thinking. But, you know, it's really easy in that to kind of fall into what I believe is somewhat of a trap or at least a limiting thing of going, oh, we believe these things because of these other things, right? Where the other things are not actually terminal values. They're instrumental ones. So to give an example, right? The reason why you defend encryption on the internet is because it helps dissidents, right? It helps people, whistleblowers or something like that. This is true, but it's going the wrong way up the line, right? I'm not in this to defend whistleblowers. I'm in this to defend encryption.
Right.
There's something else at the bottom of this, which as a side effect helps defend whistleblowers.
Right.
And so in kind of agonizing over this, I began to like sketch out what I felt my basic values were. And that's where we got into cognitive liberty, which is underlying, this is not a short.
That's why this is,
but okay,
this is
okay.
Fine.
So
keep going,
underlying this is a feeling that I think a lot of people, when the technology became personal, right, mm-hmm. when it became something that wasn't distant and big IBM mainframes or whatever, but became something that was part of you, right, and you can see this in the early sort of 70s. Activism, right? The kind of revolutionary Silicon Valley kind of thing of the personal computer revolution, right? That this was the idea of, rather than being controlled by somebody else, you have this technology and it's yours. And the thing that that describes is how your own consciousness, the way you think about things, begins to like blur onto your devices. You're,
right.
And this is when Steve Jobs says the thing about the bicycle for the mind, right?
Right.
You sit there going, oh, so now my mind rides a bicycle. No, my mind is like integrated into all of these devices.
Right. Right?
And underlying, if you look at like terminal values about a lot of the sort of free speech, right of association, freedom of conscience, these sort of things. They're all about having enough space inside your head to mm-hmm. be able to make independent decisions. And some of those are like about keeping quiet too, right? Mm-hmm. Like some of them are about like not having to reveal what you think.
Right.
And some of them are about like being able to meet with other people and talk about things without fearing that someone else is looking at it. And so this idea of sort of the liberty within the mind, this cognitive liberty idea, is something that underlies a lot of stuff in human rights. But it's sort of unspoken because up until this point, technology hasn't really given people an ability to mess with that to a huge
right.
degree. You can only limit it. You know, it's the idea of like, even if you're in prison, your mind is free, right? But also, it doesn't really extend past your head, right? Like we have this idea of like personal documents and effects, because
yeah.
the idea that maybe that cognitive liberty extends to a diary that you mm-hmm. have, right? Or your conversations with your lawyer or your religious confession. I don't know what the generic term for priest is, but that kind of relationship.
Clergy.
Yeah. Yes. But now we're in a situation where actually like the processes of my mind and my thinking and my planning and my intentionality is also leaks into a lot of things, right?
Right.
The example that I use is my Google search or Kaji search or DuckDuckGo, whatever. Like I type things into that box that I would not share. Seriously, I would not share
yes.
with my own partner, right? Like
yes.
if I was worried about like maybe I had, you know, cancer or something,
right.
I would be sharing that with Google and not sharing that with my family.
Right.
Same with like, you know, the number of notes that you write to yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you're just sort of writing down. In the very early days of Life Journal, I grabbed one of the, is it Brad Fitz, or Brian, I can't remember. Anyway, Life Journal, early blogging platform, and said, how many people use your post, you know, who can read this feature? And just write to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like 2-3% of posts are just people talking to themselves.
Right.
And my feeling is that we have to defend this as firmly as we instinctively want to defend the insides of our own heads. And more importantly, right, the insides of our own heads are also technically at risk now, right?
Yes.
Because, and this is generally the use of the term cognitive liberty, which is this idea that like we are building devices that can read your mind, right? And I mean, that is part of the thing that people fear about targeted algorithm marketing and things like that, right? It's understanding you perhaps even better than you understand yourself, and certainly with no barrier of control that you have. And my twist on this in that article is to say, not only do we have to defend that, which seems a no-brainer, we also have to defend this wider space. And that speaks to setting some lines about, you know, it would be a lot easier if in the pursuit of white supremacy or the rise of communism or terrorism or any child abuse, right? It would be great if we could not have encrypted communications, right? Or we could just flip a switch and unlock a phone, right? Or the police could, or whatever. And why don't we? Why don't we want that? And if you're working from the point of view of instrumental values, you don't have a good argument against that. Like, people go, you know, you say, oh, we're protecting encryption because we want to have the right of whistleblowers, again, to put that example. Somebody goes, yeah, but like, once they've whistleblowed, it would be great if we could untap all the communications that everybody else in that business has had, so we can prove what they're whistleblowing about. You know, oh yeah, good point. but that breaks the whole thing, right? And like, in the end, what the problem is that you end up having a negotiation, and some people willing to have that negotiation, and some people are not. And I feel pretty strongly that the stronger version of that, where you go, no, this is the line we are drawing here, is both morally and ethically the right thing, but also strategically the right thing to do. And defining where that line is comes from these terminal values, right? This terminal value of cognitive liberty, that if we break that line, then people just don't have the basic ability to be free and autonomous individuals in a society. That is it.
I think it's great. And I think it's a really interesting framing for thinking about a whole bunch of these discussions and a whole bunch of these sort of, you know, fights that are existing and ongoing, and some of which do make people uncomfortable reasonably, you know, as you described, right? You know, the questions around people using encryption for bad things is a real issue.
Right. And it also has this sort of positive element to it, because I mean, I went from EFF to FF, the Filecoin Foundation for the Decentralized Web, and have got this very strong emphasis on decentralized technologies. Mastodon, Blue Sky, you know, these things that people are playing with now, but also the next generation of those things. And also, you know, the crypto world and the D-Web, decentralized web world, like lots of people building in this area. And, you know, the strongest argument, not the strongest argument, one of definitely the really fundamental arguments here is like, well, why?
Yeah. Right?
Like, why not? Like, this is a really hard thing to pull off, first of all, right? Like, you know, it's technically more complicated. It's confusing for the end user in many ways. And it's a little bit alien, right? Why not store all our data with Google or Facebook or whatever? And, you know, if they're bad, do what we do in any other situation where somebody has a lot of power in society and regulate them.
Right.
I am sympathetic to that, right? I mean, you know, I think that's a coherent argument that is basically the argument that you would have in almost any other period in modern history, right? You would go, yeah, regulate them. If it was purely a corporate kind of thing. But this stuff is so intimate,
right,
that it becomes less like regulating the banking industry and more like regulating, like, your what goes on in your house, right? Yes. In your room, right?
It's and your intimate. Head.
And yeah. in your head, exactly. Yeah. And the other way, right, which is like, again, this technology is already in our heads, right? It's already able to do this. And no extent of regulation is going to like remove that that invasion, right? Yeah. That you can, you know, it's like, let me give an example of something which I believe is a general positive, but I like rang alarm bells when it was happening, which is the GDPR, right? Mm-hmm. So GDPR, great, right? Really is a genuine, thoughtful, based on experience, attempt to regulate one of the damaging effects of the current situation we're in, right? Which is about privacy. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of have the right to be forgotten kind of overlaid on that as a natural extension of it. Mm-hmm. One of the things about the right to be forgotten, I was just hitting this, right? Is that I'm writing a wiki, right? I have like a little internal wiki and I have little pages for my friends, right? Or like individuals, right? Mm-hmm. I had this a little Mike Masnick entry. And
oh,
it's
no.
mostly just like, yeah, yeah. It's going, stole my idea for a newsletter, right? I think, you know, most of them are actually blank, right? They're just right. like, as you build a wiki, you go, okay, this should probably have its own page.
Right.
But I'm sitting there going, this is actually kind of a violation of the GDPR, right? The GDPR, mm-hmm. there is an exception for something like household use of these things, right? But it's not really clear, like, what, like, that is not a defined thing. And the right to be forgotten is also not, right? Like people, right to be forgotten is more of an instinctive, intuitive thing that we're now building, right? That
right.
people should have that right. It has the form of a human right. But can you like, but who is doing the forgetting?
Right.
Right. Like when we say, you know, Google should remove this stuff or de-emphasize it, right? Like, fine. Okay. Like Google, you know, we're talking about like a mediator or whatever. What about me? Right. What about, like, if I'm desperately trying to remember that everything Mike Masnick ever did to me in my life or whatever, right? And very like, I have this, right? Good and bad, you know, you're still in the gray area here. Can you go actually remove this? Like,
yeah.
you can't do that. And like, obviously you can't do it in my head, right?
Right.
But this is more than my head, right? This is my exocortex, right? This is the way that I cope with the huge amount of information that we have to deal with in the world. And the perimeter cannot be, oh, it's in technology, right? It has to be, there has to be this room. And let's be clear, like, you know, the GDPR and people are working through this as they go along, but right. there isn't really an obvious guide to this. And I'm trying to think of a guide. And it's an argument for decentralized technology because that creates a technical as well as a legal perimeter around what I do because I have autonomy and control because it's my machine, right? I'm storing right. this locally. I'm not storing it in the cloud. There isn't that geographical access. And it doesn't have to be a technical solution, but I think that's part of it.
Yeah. I was going to say, so I can't send a right to be forgotten request to whoever's hosting your wiki to get me deleted from it.
So you have a right of erasure. This right. is the interesting thing. So the right to be forgotten was explicitly kept out of the GDPR. And there were actually fairly detailed negotiations. And the negotiations were not, you know, Google versus the activists. Right. It was some of the activists, including me, although I wasn't super involved in it, going, not sure that this is a good idea to do this. And then the right to be forgotten, which is really a kind of fairly narrow decision about search engines, as you know, because you wrote mm-hmm. a lot about it.
Yeah.
Kind of reanimated this somewhat careful attempt to separate right to be forgotten, which is a Franco-German kind of tradition, mm-hmm. from the right of erasure,
right.
which is like you have this, you collected this data on me. I would like, you know, I gave you this data, and now I'm deleting my account kind of model of it into a more general thing, which is, you know, this thing about me.
Right.
You have to expunge it, even though I didn't give it to you in the first place and you found out about it in perfectly legitimate ways.
Yeah. Which is leading to some awkward situations. I mean, the case that I wrote about, maybe it was last year, 2 years ago, where like Russian oligarchs who were using the right of erasure to go after journalists who were uncovering the details of like where they were all stashing their money.
Right.
And then they were making, you know, right of erasure claims on that private data. Which...
Right. And you know, you sort of sit there and you go, so the edges of it are,
yeah,
okay, this is, again, right? Like, if there are a lot, you know, governments keep the nuclear bombs, right? Like, we accord them quite a lot of trust. And, you know, I have, like, you know, a little libertarian gene in me, right? And, like, you know, there's a cypherpunk part of me that just goes, no, like, absolutely not. Like, there should be total. But I'm also, like, okay, there's also an argument that you can build a government process that has some oversight to this, mm-hmm. right? You can get some transparency into it. So when that happens, you will report on it, and then we'll go, oh God, someone's using the right of erasure in this way that we did not expect or intend. We'll set up some process by which these people are banned from, you know, whatever. But then you get into this thing, which you would also be familiar of, is if you don't think it through, you go, oh, well, we can't talk about it. because the whole point of this is we're trying to erase all this personal data, right? So, like, if we talk about these Russian oligarchs, well, don't they have a right to, like, you know, not have us reveal that they were doing a right of erasure thing? And you're sitting there going, this cannot be, like, the basic value that we are pursuing here. That we cannot be strong defenders of the right to purge everybody else's ideas of you away. There has to be a more fundamental value about it that we're trying to protect here. And it's not just a balancing act between a set of roughly commensurate kind of values. There's some underlying stuff that we have to defend more strongly, even if they are ultimately more abstract.
Yeah. And the thing, the reason why I keep thinking about this article, which gets at much of what you've just discussed, is because, you know, I mean, again, it was sort of in this publication that was all about decentralization. And I've been obviously having a bunch of conversations lately about decentralization, and in particular, decentralized social media. And everything that's happening in that space, which you mentioned a little bit as well. And it to me, like, this piece and sort of thinking about it in these terms of cognitive liberty and that being the terminal value that we're potentially most interested in has been a really useful guiding star, like, as these discussions are happening. Like, what are we trying to do when we talk about decentralizing social media? It feels like a good idea, but there are a lot of, every time you do that, one of the key things that keeps coming up is, like, there are trade-offs to every approach, and often that lets certain elements of, like, centralization creep in, and how do you balance those things and figure out what is the important thing here? And there are some people who are just like, decentralization, like, that's the end goal. Like, we need to decentralize. But the why, like, I think it has to go a step further. And that's why I thought your piece was so useful, is that it takes it a step further. It says we're not decentralizing for the sake of decentralization. We're decentralizing because it allows us to reach towards that terminal value of cognitive liberty. Right. Because that's my take on it.
Right. And it's, you know, it's like decentralization isn't just a flavor or, you know, a kind of lifestyle decision, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of the thing it's really easy to fall into, I think, because, you know, you're really, a lot of times, you as a builder, you are building something that you want to consume, right? You're scratching your own itch. And so that means you don't necessarily interrogate it a huge amount. You go, no, I just want to be on something that isn't, you know, Facebook. Like, I like Mastodon. I like Blue Sky. I like Farcaster, right? And sometimes that spills into this sort of thing that I think on the online, going back to like, you know, what are the fundamental kind of attributes of online discussion and behavior? What are the constants? You know, one of it is we kind of rationalize almost everything, right? Like someone says, well, why do you like that? Yes. I was watching this. So again, this is reasonably topical, right? But, what's the name of it? A popular key value store. This sounds like I'm trying to anonymize it. I'm literally forgetting the name of it. Switched their license from a open source to a source available license. You can watch the arguments, and the arguments, people are sort of having to construct the principle by which their instincts about why this is either perfectly okay or bad on the fly, right? Because they're in the middle of an online argument, which again is how you get to conclusions, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't, this is how I came up with, like, you know, all of these things, right? Part of the cognitive liberty is you discuss with other people, and you, that's what defines your conclusion.
Right.
Most of us don't have time or the incentive to just sit there and like really pull at this. And I think traditionally, I will say this, academics have kind of failed at this. Mm-hmm. In the early internet, just because there just wasn't enough context, right? But now I think it's because we failed, right? We failed at expressing those terminal values. So now the discussion revolves around these instrumental values. And so again, the discussion is like, well, what is this? You know, are decentralized systems going to keep the Nazis out, right? And I think that is super important. But what if Facebook is better at getting the Nazis out, right? What if, like, so again, I read an article, I think in the Financial Times, which was like, New York Times, Reddit's IPO, wouldn't have succeeded unless they'd changed their content moderation policies. And I was sitting there going, yeah, I can see that as an argument, right? Like the Reddit sort of semi-crackdown gave them a legitimacy, right? I was like going, but you know, Elon Musk's X exists, Twitter exists. Like, I can envisage a world in which Twitter did not do that and it was still kind of toxic. Like, would it really, how would that have affected the IPO price, right? Like, would you have had a bunch of, you know, sort of YOLO kind of like degenerate, whatever, kind of pushing it up because it was like, I don't know, right? It did not seem like that was a direct connection. What it meant was possibly I feel more comfortable writing about it in the New York Times because I don't think that I'm pointing people to a den of Nazis, right?
Right.
And maybe, who knows, right? The question is like, well, what are we building? And like, I think again, it's great to have competition because then you begin to see these different things and how they play out. One of the things that I think has been a kind of fallback position for you and me, right? Mm-hmm. I have been in rooms with Twitter pre-Musk and other groups wearing my, you know, either my privacy or my anti-toxicity hat or my freedom of expression hat,
right,
going, you can't moderate at scale. You are just walking into a nightmare here. You're sort of asking me to say good things about what you're doing. And like, I appreciate you're trying very hard because you're, you know, people hate you or you're worried that you'll lose good people. But this is an impossible thing that you're trying to do. I think that, I don't know that, right? You know, when Mark Zuckerberg said in front of Congress, don't worry, AI will deal with this, right? Machine learning will deal with this.
Yeah.
At the time, I was like, machine learning is never going to deal with this. Now I've modified that slightly in the face of, like, actually, I ran an experiment with Mastodon, right? I ran through everybody's posts on my thing and said, can you turn this into something that's a bit less unpleasant for me, given that these are the examples of things that freak me out when people say, like, you know, this person should die in a fire. Like, I'm just one of those people who doesn't want to hear anybody be described as should die in a fire. So you rewrite this. And, like, it was weird and plasticky and ChatGPT-ish, but I was like going, okay, this is exactly what I said couldn't work. Anyway, you, again, you and I know what our secondary argument is, which is, okay, this might work better than we thought, but there are always going to be these edge cases, and you can't build a society where someone who says Nazis must die, like, gets excluded in the same way as someone who says, you know, this minority must die, right? And we're going to do it at 2 p.m. tomorrow, right? And or the other, like, subtleties of the thing, right? And but here is the thing, right? I am arguing for a decentralized technology in a decentralized world, and we are in the moment where that's not quite uphill anymore. It's sort of a flat line at the moment where people are like, well, you know, I see the problem. I might play around with, you know, but Threads. And you go, no, not Threads. Threads is Facebook. You go, okay, I may play around with Mastodon. So we're in a moment of potential change here.
Yeah.
But we have to build something better, right? And we have to have a good expression of what better feels like and is. And that means really thinking hard about where it ends up. Oh, it seems so. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm kind of like now just sounding like a vague, abstract person. But for people who don't, people in the comment threads, right, writing, going, oh, I can't believe Blue Sky did this, or I can't believe like Mastodon hasn't improved their thing. I can guarantee that lots and lots of people who are building this stuff in this space are utterly agonizing or like spending a lot of time on it, right?
Yes.
And when they make mistakes or go in the wrong direction, we have to have a process of going, okay, what do we learn from that?
Right.
What, you know, like, what? And again, this article is fruition of, for me, of many years of both predicting things and them not turning out, or predicting things and going, I knew that would happen, right? And trying to sift through, like, what can be the guiding light in this?
Yeah.
In this space.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, it's. I think. Hopefully people listening to this get that there's a lot that it's inspired a lot of thinking in me, and I'm actually, like, I really enjoy talking it through with you and sort of getting that perspective of you listening to you explain it as well. Cause it touches on all of these issues and really kind of, you know.
So one of the things I felt for the last few years that I kind of lost is that in those 90s, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, there was a real discussion of the thrashing out of basic ideas, that a bunch of people came in with some intuitions.
Right.
And then folks like Lawrence Lessig, Stallman, Richard Stallman, you know, like, I don't want to list all of them because I forget people, right? But but a bunch of people, Dana Boyd, right? I was just reading something and going, oh, I miss Dana's kind of voice on this. And what happened was is that it went from this inchoate kind of, oh, we like the internet, but we're not quite sure why we like the internet, to a semi-coherent kind of set of principles
right.
that ended up underlying kind of the things that people see in the EFF, right? And mm-hmm. see in other groups. And what I would love to see, and I see actually in the post-crash crypto community, I know this will shock people, right? But if anyone is having a we the baddies moment, it's people trying to do good things in the crypto community, right? And so there's a really strong sense in that community and others in the decentralized web community of going, okay, can we pull this into something that makes that we can, that is both a bunch of slogans, but also something that is a generative thought system
right.
that we don't just go save encryption, but we can also go in this particular situation, we think X because like the guiding ideas that we have mean that, for instance, copyright is not going to be a good solution to the AI challenges.
Right.
Like you and I intuitively feel that.
Right.
And like we have a lot of struggle kind of going, you don't, trust me, you don't really want to sue OpenAI for the copyright in the New York Times articles. It's just really bad idea. And people are legitimately going, well, why?
Yeah.
And you go, oh, God, how do I even begin? But the benefit of a coherent discussion that creates almost a platform, a manifesto, right, is that you get more of an intuition. That intuition isn't just you, you know, talking to your guardian angel. It's you going, I have confidence in the coherence of my approach.
Right.
And I think the are we the baddies period of internet activism has meant we've kind of lost that because we've questioned everything we've stood for. And I think like that ultimately was an important stage, but now we kind of have to regroup.
Yeah.
Now, because the threats are turning on these fundamental basics.
Yes. And I would argue that some people are sort of exploiting the whole, like, are we the baddies focus?
Totally. And, you know, I have calls with people who go, I really want to say this thing, but I'm really scared that it's just going to tear our coalition apart.
Right.
And this isn't, you know, kind of the cancel mob kind of like,
right,
you know,
right.
What I really think is like, I am an artist. You know, this isn't that surface thing. It's like points of real potential disagreement. Right.
Yeah.
I don't think the way through that kind of frozen because you don't know how people are going to react thing is to sort of like blurt it out or like form factions. I think it's a sign that you need to go back and go, okay, well, what is something that will bring us all together? What are the basic values that we can go for? And then we'll build up everything on top of that again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really interesting and important way of thinking about it. And hopefully a cause for optimism.
I think so. I am. At EFF, the running joke was that, you know, I was the conflict averse activist, right? I would always go, well, you know, what do we want? Just people to chill and talk to one another. when do we want it? I don't know. Are you free? And now I'm like the last remaining, I would say techno-optimist, right? But like, apparently that term has also been stolen
someone. Yeah.
But I am like profoundly optimistic because we found a way to take the oppressive nature of digital technology. The presumption in the 1960s was that digital technology was going to be a tool of oppression. And what was happening in Eastern Europe, what was happening in, you know, the centralization of IBM and the monitoring and the surveillance, that just seemed inevitable. And that's why computers in 60s stuff are presented as a dystopian thing. And we found a way to not make them dystopian.
Yeah.
And so I have that, I still have that optimism of the early internet, which is you would be surprised, right? Like we have an existence proof that we can make internet, we can make technology that is empowering. I know it doesn't feel like it right now, but I saw it happen.
Right.
and like, I still think those roots are there. So, yeah. I default to optimism because the internet cheered me up and inspired me, and it still does to millions of people around the world.
Every yeah. Day. Yeah. No, I very much feel the same. We have to take techno optimism back from the fake optimists, I think.
So the NTK motto was, they stole our revolution and now we're stealing it back.
Yes,
and that was in 1997, right?
Yes.
Like the revolution had been stolen by, just to reveal who that was about, the editors of Wired magazine, right? And also, you know, the people at Yahoo or whatever.
Yep.
Like
yep.
the people who come into the early tech world and kind of seized it away. And I think we did steal it back to a certain extent, right? And like, you just have to keep doing that, right? Someone is going to want to commandeer your revolution for ill-gotten their gains. And you just have to keep, you just have to keep going. And I think optimism is a great way of keeping optimism, and a set of core values that you can depend on is a way of keeping going.
Yeah.
As TechTurt has shown.
Yes. And I like how we brought it back around to NTK.
Yeah. Which shut down in 2006. But honestly, the reason for that is that I just got, me and Dave got really bored, like cranking out articles. And like,
yeah, it's work. Turns
it's
out.
It's work. Yeah. People should understand that, man.
And just as a closing note, I will do this horrible crass thing where I'm going to cross promote my other podcast, because Danny mentioned the article about Reddit and the IPO.
Oh yeah.
And whether or not, you know, it was like because of content moderation. I have a long discussion of that on our other podcast.
Perfect.
Control Alt Speech. So if you want to hear that, go subscribe to that and listen to that, because we have a whole discussion about whether or not that's an accurate portrayal of what
and
happened.
And if you want another podcast,
go for it.
Like, this is a podcast summarizing all the other podcasts. No, sadly it isn't. We should do that. But D-Web Decoded, which is my podcast that you've already heard because it was in the spool. And actually, just generally, I would like, if you've lasted this long in this conversation, there is a really fascinating conversation going on right now, which is half in the crypto community, half in the kind of traditional sort of WebTorrent, IPFS, HyperCore, Blue Sky, Mastodon, all of these veiled, sprightly, all of these new protocols that are emerging. And if you've kind of held your nose and gone, ugh, NFTs, God, what's going on? No, I'm getting out of that space. I really invite you to come back. Or just sniff around again, because the crash means that the people who are left are always the interesting people trying to do something. So I know, maybe we can talk about that in another time.
Yeah,
there's stuff in crypto that's going on.
Yeah, at some point I have a half-written paper. I have a bunch of these half-written papers. But one of the half-written papers that I have that I would like to finish is kind of like, what good things can we take out of the almost, you know, probably 99.9% nonsense of the NFT space?
Yeah.
And like, there are some really interesting ideas in there that we should not throw out with all of the garbage that came with it.
You know, when I moved into the space, it wasn't just about the money. Because for one thing, it's somewhat imaginary money, right? Yes. Like unfortunately, it's not real. No. It's great. Don't stop paying me. but was because there's just been like this huge swash of capital investment into amazing things, not just blockchain, but like really, this is another conversation. We've already talked too much, but we'll invite each other back into one of the 12 podcasts
we
and other white middle-aged men run. and then we can talk about that too.
Yes. But either way, this is always fun to catch up with you.
You too.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and thank you everyone who made it this far, hopefully. I hope we kept it interesting. I found it very interesting. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And we will be back next week with something else.
Thanks very much, Dan.
Thanks. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. Duh. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap. Duh. If we don't stand up to them, someone will get. To grab a shovel and dig up the tap.